Imagine if among the tired, poor, and huddled masses there was another group of immigrants who yearned to be free in America, vampires. Now, suppose there was such persecution in Europe that the new land was just as attractive to the undead as it was to the pilgrims. Now, stay with me here. There are good and bad mortals, right? So, consider that the forces of good and evil are at work in the immortal world, and that in 19th century America, those forces battled for the soul of the new republic. We know it as the Civil War. Seth Graham Smith explores the premise in a new book you can really sink your teeth into. It's called Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. He's in our NPR West studio. And Seth, just how much disbelief must be suspended while we're reading your book?
Well, a great deal, because the premise of the book is absurd. It's Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. I mean, you know, my goal in writing the book was to add as much real factual history as possible and weave it in as seamlessly as possible to make people, to actually trick people into thinking that they were reading a real biography in the style of, say, David McCullough or Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Sure. Your premise actually rests on quote-unquote journals kept by Lincoln. Are these entries completely created by you?
They are. Lincoln never really kept a journal, definitely not a secret journal about his lifelong battle with the undead. But the premise of the book is that I, as a struggling writer, was granted exclusive access to these long-lost journals.
Give us some example of elements of actual fact that you used as a jumping-off place for the fiction.
Well, really, most of the seminal events of Lincoln's life, starting with the death of his mother when he was 9 years old, a death that greatly affected him and the rest of his life. But in this case, I attribute that death to vampires. And so as he finds this out as a young man, he swears vengeance against the blood-sucking immortals.
Like many biographies, there are actual pictures in here. And there is a picture, and you write about Lincoln and the poet Edgar Allan Poe. Did they ever really meet?
They never did. Although Lincoln was a great admirer of all things Gothic literature, and he could recite The Raven from memory at one point in his life. So he was a fan of Poe's work. And as we all know, Lincoln could be particularly morbid in his sort of darker days. But it just seemed like it would be a lot of fun for them to sort of partner up in the fight against the undead.
Sure. And using the factual interest in all things Gothic, it was sort of natural that you got him involved in vampires?
Right. I mean, he's this very tall, sunken eyes, and, you know, he's the original goth.
Let's go back to the premise, the battle for a United States. Abraham Lincoln finds out that he's a designated slayer, essentially, and his undead mentor is a character called Henry Sturgis. Give us a nutshell bio of this vampire.
He's this very cool Englishman who was made against his will into a vampire when he was in his early 20s, and so he's this perpetually youthful, but very old, very wise soul. And he, like a small number of vampires, believes in the coexistence between man and vampire. You know, he doesn't believe, like so many vampires in this book do, of the enslavement of all mankind because, you know, vampires see themselves as superior beings. And so Henry acts as the advisor to Abe. He teaches him how to fight vampires. He tells him the history of vampires. He reveals these secrets throughout the book.
Why doesn't he feast on Lincoln?
Well, because he thinks that Abe is too interesting to kill. He sees something special in him, and he senses that there's a greatness in him from early on. And actually, Henry plays a big role in sort of propelling Abe forward in his political career later in life as well.
Right. Slavery is one of the main political issues that the book revolves around. Now, did this get wrapped up in your vampire plot because vampires see themselves as masters?
That's one of the central themes of the book is tying vampirism and slaveholding together. I see them as sort of one and the same. I mean, both creatures, basically slaveholders and vampires, steal the lives, take the blood of others to enrich themselves. So it made sense to me that the bad vampires in this book would be in league with some of the slaveholders.
You know, your first book was a publishing sensation, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And Abe Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, follows the same direction, only this one's based on historical record, not the vampire part, but historical record. Was it more or less difficult for you as a writer to blend the fantastic with fact, as opposed to doing it with fiction, as you did before?
It was more difficult to write Lincoln, by far. I mean, not just because of the word count. You know, I probably added all in about 25,000 words to Jane Austen's original Pride and Prejudice. Mm-hmm. And the challenge there was to blend in with the spirit and the tone and the style of Austin's writing, and it was a big challenge. But there was really just one text to work with. Here, you're working from multiple histories. You're working from letters and speeches and biographies and websites, and you're sort of having to create an entire picture of Lincoln to work from and then twist that picture into something fictional. And it was significantly more difficult and more rewarding to work on Lincoln.
Hmm. So will you continue to mine this rich vein? In other words, can we expect a Great Gatsby Ghost Whisperer or PT-109 and Poltergeists?
Right. Or maybe, you know, Wuthering Heights Reloaded. You could go on and on. I don't think so. I think that we are still sort of in this mashup moment in literature that, you know, was spawned in large part by the success of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And, you know, that was a great exercise. And I think it was something new that people responded to. And I think I want to keep moving forward. I think that, you know, I'll always write with a little bit of supernatural, a little bit of history, maybe some pop culture. But the more books I do, the more I want to get into original storytelling and still keep those elements alive.
Seth Graham Smith is the author of the new book, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. He joined us from NPR West. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Thirty years ago, one of the world's great puzzles came to this country. The multicolored device was called the Magic Cube when it first went on sale in a Budapest toy shop. But in 1980, once the Ideal Toy Corporation started importing it to the United States, the puzzle carried the name of its inventor, Hungarian architecture professor Erno Rubik. The professor was actually more interested in solving a structural design problem than creating a puzzle when he developed the Rubik's Cube. And once he started fidgeting with it, he feared he would never again be able to get all of the colors to properly align themselves. He did, though, after a month of twisting. Since those early experimental days, more than 350 million Rubik's Cubes have been sold planet-wide, and according to the official Rubik's website, Erno Rubik is comfortably enjoying his retirement.
There's a good chance, as an NPR listener, you've come across a forwarded email from a friend describing a recent report about how NPR's funding is about to be cut off. Usually, it describes Nina Totenberg, our legal affairs correspondent, as the one breaking the bad news. Well, that email, or a version of it, has been circulating on the internet since 1995. And no, it's not true, but don't let that stop you from making a contribution to your local public radio station, please. Anyway, you may have also come across this story that a woman named Barbara Mickelson tells.
Well, I can remember feeling absolutely aghast when a friend had told me how the daughter of another friend had come back from Mexico after meeting some wonderful guy down there, and after spending 2 weeks of wild romance down there, she unwrapped this gift from him on the plane. It was a coffee cup, and looked at it, and it said, "Welcome to the world of AIDS."
Barbara Mickelson used to believe that story. It shocked her. That is, until she started hearing many, many different versions of it. Sometimes it was a coffee mug, sometimes a ceramic coffin, sometimes it was a note scrawled in lipstick on a hotel mirror. She eventually discovered the story was a lie, an urban legend, and that moment changed her life. Barbara Mickelson and her husband David are the mythbusters behind the website Snopes.com. All day long, they scour the internet and sometimes even the bookshelves at real brick-and-mortar libraries, and they look for information. Information to bust myths and rumors that circulate online, like
asparagus, about the idea that asparagus wards off cancer,
or
an upcoming film that will supposedly portray Jesus as gay,
or
a plea to find missing girl named Ashley Flores. That's another favorite. She was never missing.
And every month, about 5 million people visit Snopes.com to find out, for example, whether it's true that Oliver North once warned Al Gore about Osama bin Laden in 1987. It's not. Or if there really was a basketball court inside the peak of the Matterhorn at Disneyland.
There isn't now, but there was a half court way up there that was just sort of used for employee fun time.
All that myth-busting comes out of the Mickelsons' two-bedroom prefab home perched above a stream deep in the hills outside Los Angeles, a home they share with five cats and three rats.
We can see what we sort of heuristically refer to as my office, although it's actually a bedroom for cats in which they have graciously consented to sublet space.
The Mickelsons used to allow their rats to roam free, but they started to chew up the internet cables and phone lines strewn along the floors.
They had to stay in cages after that.
And they seem perfectly fine with that. Aside from the rat cage, the house is packed with cat toys, cables, old magazines, and books. Hundreds of books.
This whole area up here is all of word etymologies and phrases, ideas of where various words came from, when they entered the language, how they've changed.
Every rumor or legend the Mickelsons debunk or confirm is backed by carefully footnoted research. Often they add links to original documents, official transcripts, or video. The story of how Snopes.com got started begins in the early 1990s when Barbara was living in Ottawa, Canada, and David was here in Agoura Hills, California.
Barbara and I actually met online back in the pre-web days. We met on a text-based online discussion group about urban legends. So we, you know, emailed back and forth for a while, and I went and visited her in Ottawa, and afterwards, she came out here to live with me.
And by 1995, Snopes was up and running.
We never had any intent of running what our site has become now. It was intended to be sort of like an encyclopedic reference of urban legends, but we ended up going where the audience led us, which was writing about all kinds of political screeds, scams, hoaxes, missing child alerts, you know, household warnings, and everything else that circulates on the internet.
And it turns out in many, many cases, the legends they debunk are modern versions of very old stories.
We tell now about a story about a woman who was at a shopping mall and comes back and finds that her car is disabled, it has a flat tire, or perhaps just won't start. And then there's a helpful stranger that seems a little creepy who is offers to help her. And
the man then tries to get in the car with her. She drives off and later discovers a bag he left in her trunk. Inside is duct tape, an axe, and a rope.
There was a precursor to that from the prior to the American Civil War, in which the a suspicious passenger in a stagecoach was basically tricked and gotten out of the stagecoach by the driver so that they could ride off without her, because it was dressed as a woman. And only afterwards they find the carpet bag of the supposed lady. And, of course, it contains a great big revolver.
At Snopes.com, the Mickelsons keep a tally of the 25 hottest urban legends circulating around the internet at any given time.
Some things are literally around for years and never go away.
Even after you've debunked them.
Yes, they've been in our top 25 list almost constantly for years. They're kind of like the equivalent of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon on the Billboard chart. They're just there for years and they never go away.
Things like warnings about computer viruses or the email that says if you forward it, Microsoft will send you a free laptop or free cash. Now, while a lot of the rumors the Mickelsons deal with might seem silly or harmless, many they say are not, like the persistent emails that suggest President Obama is a foreign agent bent on undermining America, or a recent photograph circulating on the net in which Michelle Obama poses behind an apple that seems to reflect the image of Karl Marx. Many people actually believe this stuff.
I will confess there are my mornings when I go to Dave and I'd say, why are we doing this website again? Why is everyone so crazy? But I also look at my inbox and see all of the emails that come in from perfectly normal people, from folks who write to say, thanks, I was about to get taken by this scam.
Oh, and one more thing. You know how, despite it all, Mussolini still managed to keep the trains running on time? Well, that's a myth, too. You can read about it at Snopes.com, and you can see a photograph of the Mickelsons at our website, npr.org. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, reporting this week from NPR West in Southern California. Democratic leaders say they have the votes to overhaul health care.
I have the commitment of a significant majority of the United States Senate to make that good law even better.
That's Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid speaking on Capitol Hill today. There will be two House votes now, both expected tomorrow night. One on reconciliation, the so-called fixes to the Senate bill passed in December, and another on the actual Senate bill. More on that in a moment from our correspondent Julie Rovner. If those two bills do pass in the House, one goes to the president to sign, the other goes to the Senate next week for a final vote. The legislation promises to extend health coverage to 32 million uninsured Americans. Earlier today, President Obama drove down Pennsylvania Avenue to rally the members on Capitol Hill.
We have been debating health care for decades. It has now been debated for a year. It is in your hands. It is time to pass health care reform for America, and I am confident that you are going to do it tomorrow. Thank you very much, House of Representatives. Let's get this done.
Just steps from the Capitol building, several thousand opponents of Mr. Obama's plan staged their own rally.
It would be great if we could really afford to provide health care for everybody in this country, but money doesn't grow on trees. And health care is not a right. It's something that you have to work for.
We're going to have socialized medicine, and we are not a socialist country.
The voices of protesters Catherine Allen and Mary Ellen Jones on Capitol Hill today, they both oppose health care overhaul. Inside the Capitol, on the House floor, several members of Congress made their final arguments ahead of tomorrow night's votes. Here's Connecticut Democrat Jim Himes.
We look after our own. But if you're one of the tens of thousands of people diagnosed with breast cancer, coronary disease, leukemia, well, then we're not sure. We might look after you.
At times, there were tense exchanges between House members. Texas Republican Joe Barton said most Americans do not want this legislation passed, which sparked this response from Florida Democrat Elsie Hastings.
You don't know what all of the American people
but we
think.
Do. We
and
do.
You certainly don't know what those
But we do read the polls, Mr. Hastings.
Of this bill.
Reclaiming my time, if I may.
Mr. Diaz-Balart, we need to vote.
Our coverage this hour begins with NPR's Julie Rovner on Capitol Hill. And Julie, can you describe the scene inside the Capitol building now?
Well, you know, it's always a strange time when the House is in on a weekend. Outside, of course, it is a beautiful spring day. There was a marathon this morning. We've, of course, had the Tea Party protest. And inside, there's just all these meetings going on. Democrats trying to make sure that they have the votes, people wanting last-minute favors, wanting to make sure that what they want is in the bill. So there's lots of scurrying about and lots of secrecy and lots of tension and filling the air.
Now, the big news today, Julie, apparently comes from the House Rules Committee. It appears they are not going to use this so-called deem and pass maneuver that we've been hearing so much about this week.
That's right. This all has to do with getting the House to pass the bill the Senate passed in December. Now, the House really doesn't like the Senate bill, but it has to pass it in the form the Senate did because the Senate no longer has the 60 votes anymore to block a Republican filibuster if the bill had to go back to that chamber. So the House was going to do that deem and pass technique where the Senate bill would have been part of a bigger rules package and the House would basically have been voting on two things at once. It would have been an indirect vote, if you will. Then they were going to vote on that second bill, making changes to the Senate bill that would make it more to the House likings. That bill does go back to the Senate, but now it only needs 51 votes.
So one vote will, if it passes, it's presumed to pass, will go to the president. The other one, when it passes, will go to the Senate.
That's right.
So why the change of heart on the way that they're going to vote now?
Well, apparently they got the word from the Senate parliamentarian that it was all right to vote on the Senate bill after they vote on the bill with the changes to the Senate bill. That makes that standalone vote much more palatable and easier to get the votes for. And having the vote separate this way takes away a big source of criticism by Republicans who've been all over the Democrats this past week for what they call an abuse of the process.
And just to clarify, Julie, my understanding is that once the House passes these two pieces of legislation, the Senate bill that was passed in December will become law for a few days until the Senate passes the House reconciliation bill.
That's right. The Senate bill goes straight to the president because it will have passed both the House and the Senate in the same form. And then the reconciliation bill with the changes in it goes to the Senate for passage.
Speaking of getting the votes, Julie, anti-abortion Democrats have been a crucial block in the House. Where do they stand now?
Indeed they have, and they've been some of the holdout votes for the Democrats. And at least for now, it appears that Democratic leaders have cut off negotiations with a group of anti-abortion lawmakers who wanted even stronger abortion restrictions in the bill. It's a group led by Michigan Democrat Bart Stupak. He's been saying he has as many as 12 members who won't vote for the bill unless the abortion restrictions that were in the House version of the bill are put back. But among other things, it appears his group really isn't that big. Several anti-abortion groups, including the group that represents Catholic hospitals and a group of more than 50,000 nuns, have said they believe the Senate bill, which also has abortion restrictions, really does prohibit federal funding of abortion. That's good enough to have peeled off several pro-life Democrats in the House to say they'll vote for the Senate bill, despite the opposition of groups like the National Right to Life Committee and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And while there's still some discussion going on, perhaps President Obama might issue an executive order to confirm that there'll be no federal funding of abortion in the bill. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said she will not allow a separate vote on stronger abortion restrictions. That seems to mean she thinks she can afford to lose that handful of votes.
So basically, the Democrats need 216 votes. It means that about 37 Democrats don't have to support this.
That's correct.
If my math is right.
That's exactly correct.
Okay. So what happens tomorrow, Julie?
Well, it's probably going to be a long day. There won't be a lot of debate on the floor. This bill obviously has been debated a lot over the last 6 months. But you can still expect House Republicans to do whatever they can to drag things out. I've been warned, one staffer warned me to maybe bring a cot. They really, really, really don't like this bill. And even if they don't have the votes, they intend to go down fighting. And then the bill, the second bill at least, as we mentioned, has to go back to the Senate. But that's a problem for next week.
That's NPR's Julie Rovner on Capitol Hill. Julie, I can lend you my cot.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. People who manage forests long have debated how much to intentionally burn them. Intentional fires can remove some of the forest debris that fuels bigger, uncontrolled wildfires. Now there's a new wrinkle in the debate. Because forests soak up climate-warming carbon dioxide, scientists are trying to figure out whether small fires make forests better carbon collectors. NPR's Christopher Joyce has more.
The kind of fire we're talking about here is one that people intentionally set. I watched a so-called prescribed burn in a forest in Brazil, along with fire ecologist Jennifer Balch.
The plan is to measure the fire and see where it's at. We're going to map the fire lines.
It sounds hot, and it is hot. And as soon as they start the fire, even though the wind's blowing the other direction, you can feel the heat. The important thing is keep moving with the fire and watch out for snakes.
Balch is an ecologist with the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis, who studies how forest fires burn. She says for decades, forest managers in the U.S. have focused on suppressing fires. As a result, a lot of forests that used to burn naturally every now and then are choked with downed wood and undergrowth.
It's kind of like a jack-in-the-box phenomenon where if you keep storing carbon in forests that historically have burned, eventually you're going to get a surprise if you don't burn at least semi-frequent intervals.
The surprise being a really whopping big wildfire. In addition to what it destroys on the ground, a wildfire emits thousands of tons of carbon that eventually warm the atmosphere. Balch says the government spends four times as much money every year fighting fires than it does on preventive measures, such as controlled burns. So many ecologists have been pushing for more prescribed fires. To keep them small, crews surround the burn area with fire breaks, essentially paths that are scraped clean of anything flammable. Crews also make sure the fire isn't started on a dry, windy day. Christine Widenmeyer is a scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research.
Prescribed burning, if it's done correctly, you only burn the understory and you leave a lot of trees living, and therefore they can continue to sequester carbon as opposed to a large wildfire that wipes everything out.
But one nagging question has been, which puts more carbon up into the atmosphere? A series of small prescribed burns or the occasional big wildfire? So Widenmeyer developed a computer model to calculate that, using the record of both kinds of fires in the western U.S. from 2001 to 2008. She published the results in the journal Environmental Science and Technology. Although the numbers are rough, the outcome is clear. prescribed fires do emit carbon, but much less than the wildfires they prevent.
We could reduce the emissions from wildfires by as much as 25%, and fires emit a significant amount of CO2 to the atmosphere.
Wittenmeyer points out that big wildfires also create more smog, ozone, and particulate pollution that are not only annoying but cause health problems for people living nearby. Wittenmeyer notes, however, that these same people aren't always eager to see prescribed fires in their neighborhood either.
I live near an area that has regular prescribed burning, and people, if they're unaware of what's going on, they get a little worried.
Fire ecologists say the nation needs a plan for prescribed burns because forests are becoming valuable carbon banks. Industries and even individuals can now offset their own carbon emissions by paying someone else to preserve or grow forests. But that could turn many forests into overgrown tinderboxes and even discourage prescribed burns, since those fires would, in effect, be like burning part of someone's bank account. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
The martini cocktail, long the embodiment of style and sophistication, is popular again. Today, however, it's often served with a unique twist. Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolfe is a little shaken, but not stirred.
Can you imagine James Bond asking for a chocolate butterscotch martini? Or an apple martini, lemon drop martini, or prickly pear martini? Unlikely for the suave super spy. Putting a drink in a long-stemmed V-shaped glass does not make it a martini. A martini is this: gin and dry vermouth, and maybe an olive or two, or a twist of lemon peel. It is ice cold and crystal clear, not green or pink. The martini is an icon, what writer H.L. Mencken called the only American invention as perfect as the sonnet. A martini recipe appears as early as 1882 in a bartender's manual, although in addition to gin and vermouth, it calls for sweet syrup. Over the years, the martini got drier and drier. Martinis were popular in Prohibition speakeasies, probably because it was easier to make gin in a bathtub than whiskey. Ever after, the martini was the height of urbanity. American writer Bernard DeVoto wrote, "The martini is a city dweller, a metropolitan. It is not to be drunk beside a mountain stream or anywhere else in the wilds." Think Katharine Hepburn, Cary Grant, Art Deco furnishings in wood-paneled bars. A martini defined cool and modern. 1950s jazz saxophonist Paul Desmond said he wanted the sound of a dry martini. Just listen to his composition, Take Five. From roughly the same era, the TV show Mad Men is careful with period details. So many of the characters drink martinis at bars, cocktail parties, or when they get off the train from Manhattan. Mad Men also shows the downside of the three martini lunch style: car crashes, failed marriages, lost jobs. The martini star faded in the late 1960s and 70s, with opposition to expense account dining rising, health food stores gaining on liquor stores, and the popularity of other mind-altering substances. Classic cocktails made a comeback in the 1980s, and things began to run amok. Frou-frou-tinis featuring flavored vodka, fruit purees, even bacon bits have become common in raucous bars with loud music. All wrong for the drink that writer E.B. White called the elixir of quietude.
Food commentator Bonnie Wolfe. This is NPR News.